chance so bright. Oh, there's another thing, Mama. I think I should confide. It is not love. That'll turn the tide. But the net difference in the gravitational pull between the Earth and the Moon as it is acted out upon the waves. But since you're gone, I feel washed away. I could have been a mathematician, studied rockets for a living. Would have worked out better in the end. But to get more specific, I break every law of physics to bring you back to me again. But there's one more thing I'll tell you if I can. It is not love that makes a nonstick frying pan, but a top-secret trademark conglomerated, most likely carcinogenic, polyurethane compound spreading a micro-thin substance over a negatively charged layer of aluminum, copper, iron, lead, VHS, FYI, apple pie, FBI, and some other elements too. Since you're gone, I wish I'd stuck to you.
Hey, all you listeners out there, welcome again to the second show of Splice, Dominican's first one and only science radio variety show. This is your host, Tortula, and I hope you'll stick with us because today we have a very special topic, one very close to my heart, and that is genetics. You just finished listening to Camarole with Lady Madonna, and now you're on the second show of Splice. We're gonna stick it to some interesting genes and also look at recent news, hold a junior journal club where we'll look at one interesting article from the week and try to take it apart. And we'll also stop in to check in with the world news, look at the history of genetics, and a lot more coming up, plus some really clever songs. So stay tuned, stick with us here on Splice on radio.dominican.edu. For the next hour, we'll be talking about genetics. So for those of you who are looking for a very precise definition of genetics to get your Splice listening hour started off well, genetics is the science that studies the principles and mechanisms of heredity, specifically the means by which traits are passed from parents to offspring and the causes of the similarities and differences between related organisms. So, if you're wondering what that all means in plain English, it's why you look like your mom and not your cat Fluffy. Some of you might prefer to look like your cat Fluffy. I don't know. Depends what Fluffy looks like. So, there are multiple types of genetic studies, of course, because this is science. Everyone likes to specialize with their own little niche. They include molecular genetics, which looks at the molecular structures like DNA and how those influence our heredity and how those function to make the proteins and the characteristics that make us us, and even to some extent, the intellectual and mental abilities. There's also clinical genetics, which I like to call X-Men genetics, and it's a study of mutations and genetic mutants and the diseases or the advantages they have within a population. And last, since we mentioned populations, on a much broader scale, we have population genetics, which is the genetics of large populations and how those change over time. You can basically think of this almost as the genetics of evolution or extinction, depending on your species. So the two we're going to cover today are molecular genetics, which we'll touch on just briefly. We might visit it again. And clinical genetics, which we'll cover with my top five favorite genetic disorders. To begin with, let's go over a brief history of genetics in order of increasing complexity. So our understanding of genetics started out very simple, with Aristotle believing there's some sort of mystical blood fluid from your parents that get passed on to you that somehow influence how you are, which is why you're more like your parents than maybe your neighbors. There were three original theories later, much past the original Greeks. The first is acquired traits. Acquired traits means that your parents acquire traits over a lifespan, which then get passed on to you. So, for example, if your dad had a really buff right arm, you should also have a really buff right arm. So this might sound a little ridiculous to us now, but to the ancients, it sort of made sense. And by ancients, I kind of mean the 18th century, which seems ancient on the genetic timescale based off what we know now. However, these acquired traits try to explain things like why a giraffe's neck was long. It didn't make sense to a lot of these old biologists to have this idea that the giraffe was born with a slightly longer neck each time. However, if the giraffe's parents stretched their neck just a little bit each time, maybe over multiple generations, that stretched neck was inherited and then emphasized over time. So you end up with a very, very long neck accumulated. The next theory of genetics, besides acquired traits, was pangenesis, which was actually the theory supported by Charles Darwin, the father of modern evolution. Charles Darwin supported pangenesis on the basis of his observations in the field, which was a combination of the transmission of inherited or acquired traits, as well as the inheritance of genetic traits. So it was kind of a mix of acquired traits and inherited traits as we know today. Pangenesis was based off the idea that small hereditary particles aggregated from the body into the reproductive organs. So the organs would produce these small particles based off of their function or their whatever they had originally started as. These particles would move to your reproductive organs, and those particles, when mixed with your father's particles or your mother's, would form a baby of equal portions, or roughly equal portions. He was so passionate that he actually got his half-cousin, Francis Galton, to test this out in a long series over about 2 years, plus another 8 afterwards, after the original experiments that disproved it, looking at inheritance through blood samples. And eventually Charles Darwin went to his cousin, looked at all the evidence, and said he had made a huge number of assumptions in proposing this theory in the first place, and in all likelihood, it wasn't correct. Later, we had the development of inherited traits. Now, inherited traits is probably the genetics you're familiar with, that all our traits come from our DNA, which comes half from our mother, half from our father, and not actually what our parents do, unless they, you know, do some weird, funky carcinogen mutations within their little germ cells, which is unlikely. So usually you have inherited traits from your parents' DNA, which isn't affected by their life. Only their reproductive success is affected by their life, not your genetics. This theory of inherited traits is most often credited as starting with Gregor Mendel, who was a monk, a Catholic monk, who was probably educated in an institution somewhere along the lines of Dominican, though mostly male, if not all male. And Mendel was trained in the church, and at that time, the Catholic Church was a huge supporter of biological science as part of explaining the mystery and wonder of God's magical work. Whether you agree with that or not, it was actually the main supporter of science in Europe around that time, besides people who looked at science as a hobby. So Mendel had a small garden in the monastery where he grew peas, and he did selective breeding of these peas. So he'd take one pea that had a very clear established trait and breed it with another pea that had a different established trait. So for example, you might have a pea that had yellow flowers and a pea that had purple flowers. And then he'd pick out the pollinators and then brush the pollen onto the specific plants so they would only breed with each other, and look at the results. And from this, we learned about simple recessive and dominant traits. So, in case you didn't know, all chromosomes come in two pairs. So you have two alleles, and each allele can have a different version of the genes. And these genes establish our traits. So, for example, you might have a trait for brown hair and a trait for blue eyes and a trait for funny ears that stick out. And some of these might be recessive, for example, blue eyes. So you'd have to have two alleles for blue eyes. But some of these traits are dominant, like brown hair. So you'd only have to have one. And that brown hair could be covering up something else. For example, you could have one allele for brown hair and one allele for blonde hair. From his simple pea plants, he deduced that we in fact have two alleles, which was kind of groundbreaking. It showed what the traits were, how they were inherited, where they came from, why you might not perfectly match your parents. Yet his research was kept almost privately in these little journals and was not recognized until after his death. The term genetics wasn't even coined by Mendel. It wasn't coined until 1905. The next person who had a big influence on inherited traits was Thomas Hunt Morgan, who did significant work with fruit flies, or Drosophila, using chromosomes as a mechanical basis for inheritance. He looked at the mutation which causes either white eyes or black eyes in flies, and he found that this mutation could be linked to specific points on the fly's chromosome. He was the first person to actually identify the genetic spot of different traits. Later, when we look at a variance in traits between parents and children, we wonder why some traits mix up. So, for example, your mother might have blue eyes and funny sticky out ears, but you might only get the blue eyes and not the funny sticky out ears, even though your father also has the funny sticky out ears. This could be caused by crossing over. Crossing over is the process during which gametes are formed, which is called meiosis, in which you end up with a cell which has half the normal number of chromosomes. Half this number of chromosomes, and this cell combines with another gamete formed by your other parent, which also has half the number. So these two combine, and during this process, actually, the genes in each parent sort of flip places and scramble. So the alleles on one chromosome could mix with the alleles on the other chromosome. So you end up with this kind of hybrid chromosome that could have a variance of traits. So just as a short little review, I know that's a lot to take in. Gregor Mendel covered that the idea of inherited traits being dominant or recessive. So this means that a dominant trait can mask a recessive trait, but if you have two copies of the recessive trait is expressed. So for example, if you have a brown hair allele and a blonde hair allele, the brown hair allele will cover up the blonde hair allele. However, if you have two blonde hair alleles, the blonde hair allele will be expressed. That if you have two brown hair alleles, you still have brown hair because it was dominant to begin with. You can check out more of this if you aren't familiar with it by just typing in Punnett squares into Google, and it'll bring up a whole system of little squares that will give you the exact combination and ratios of dominant to recessive traits with different offspring pairings, which is exactly how Gregor Mendel did it back in the 18th century. So check that out. Fascinating stuff. And then Thomas Hunt Morgan looked at flies and was able to determine that these points of recessive alleles and dominant alleles were located on chromosomes in flies. Later, it was looked at by two amazing women scientists, Harriet Creighton and Barbara McClintock, in 1931. Who established that crossing over occurred in chromosomes, which gives you a nice mix of chromosomes in an individual. So your chromosomes are not exact matches of your parents, but rather they are scrambled of your two parents' chromosomes, and then those scrambles paired together. So when your mom or dad creates a gamete, you take your parents' chromosomes, they do this little twisty dance, and parts of the chromosome break off and attach in different places. So you have a mixing of alleles, and then they separate. So now you have single chromosomes where normally you have two chromosomes in an egg. And that happens in both adults. And those two single individual chromosomes come together, pair up, and make a completely genetically new individual, giving us lots of genetic diversity to work with and a lot of wide variation, not only in individuals, but also in siblings. So this was, once again, discovered by two amazing female scientists, Harriet Creighton and Barbara McClintock. They're both fascinating stories, especially Barbara McClintock, who went on to look at transposons, which is another interesting subject if you want to look at genetic variability and changes in genetics between generations and parents and their offspring. She looked at actually the color variation in corn kernels. So check out Barbara McClintock. Excellent scientist, very interesting lady. Little before her time, I feel. Later, after these two amazing women, there was the famous Hershey-Chase experiment that isolated the DNA from viruses to show that DNA was the source of genetic information passage, not actually the protein code. So until this point, no one actually knew, even after identifying the alleles, if it was the DNA or the proteins that were changing this inherited messages. And after identifying DNA as the key component for this inheritance, Watson and Crick determined the structure of DNA based off of these very interesting little almost helical x-rays that Rosalind Franklin developed. She later died of cancer, presumably from the exposure from taking these x-rays. So that's a tragic and interesting story about women in science. If you're interested, that's Rosalind Franklin and Watson and Crick and the discovery of DNA. By the way, Crick is still at it, doing research very actively. This summer, I was lucky enough to hear him speak at University of Washington in Seattle. Still kicking, really interesting research, shows you the longevity of a scientist and the ability of adapting. Also, how things in your youth don't necessarily define you. Well, that's how we ended up with the structure of DNA across many scientists. And eventually, in April 14th, 2003, earlier than expected, amazingly surprising for a government project, we had the successful completion of the Human Genome Project. This was the first fully sequenced genome. Since then, there have been over 100 animals sequenced, including recently the first lizard genome. This lizard genome was a long time coming. It has been on the tail of sequencing Drosophila, which is the fruit fly, as well as sequencing the sequencing of viral DNA and a myriad of others, including some plants and some algae. It currently costs around $30,000 to have your genome sequenced, if you have an interest in that, though the price is expected to drop really soon, and almost exponentially so, following the pattern of computer chips, where the technology, it keeps much quicker pace and becomes a logarithmic growth rather than an exponential growth, which is good for us, since it means that we're going to get this technology sooner. So maybe in, 5 or 6 years, you pay $1,000, get your entire genome, get to look for all the interesting things and mutations, and perhaps be able to screen yourself for cancer or maybe discover some intelligence, maybe, though those are very hard to predict. It has most potential, at least according to most people, most scientists that choose to talk about it, for disease screening. So, on that note, I'm going to play a brief song before we stop in for the news of the day. This is a very funny song, an ode to Gregor Mendel, the famous monk I was talking about earlier, and his peas. It's done in honor and style of the monks, and I really, really hope you enjoy it, because I did when I listened to it last night. So enjoy, and I'll be right back with the news.
Did you make it so complex to understand the offspring that result when there is sex? But there is one monk among us who can tell how it all works. We feel like jerks next to Gregor Mendel.
The answer's in my garden, where I planted different peas and sprinkled pollen as I pleased and counted out the progeny.
What did you discover in your garden with your peas about those factors we can't see but which explain our family trees?
Here's the news, they come in twos, they separate. It's up to fate if an egg or a sperm has a trait that will dominate.
Here's the news, they come in twos, they segregate. It's up to fate if an egg or a sperm has a trait that will dominate.
And when they join together, my forecasting's most impressive. Bet you three times out of four I'm right, unless they're both recessive.
To what do you owe your success?
To counting and my green thumb. But where these hidden factors are, well, that I cannot fathom.
Here's the news, they come in twos, they segregate. It's up to fate if an egg or a sperm has a trait that will dominate. Later on, the world was odd and what he learned from those pods. But back then, no one hurrahed Gregor Mendel but his God. Back then, no one hurrahed Gregor Mendel but his God.
Well, don't worry, now we definitely hurrah Gregor Mendel in almost every single class we have in biology, especially in genetics. So, are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready to hear about the news of the day? Here we go. Here's the latest in current events in the United States and a little bit abroad. Troy Davis was executed Wednesday, September 21st. The United States is currently the fifth in the world for executions in 2010 with 46, which is 1.5 per million people. We are currently one of the few industrialized nations to continue capital punishment. This is a major issue for doctors currently, especially those who are involved in the judicial system. It brings up bioethical concerns, especially the do no harm Hippocratic Oath that all doctors take. In fact, in the Hippocratic Oath, it has a specific line about not giving any individual poison which you would know to end their life. Another bioethical concern, though, is if a doctor is not present, there would be no one to compensate for complications during the execution. So, is it more humane to be there and make sure the process goes as humanely as possible, or should doctors refuse to do it completely? In other news, it was recently calculated that 1 million uninsured young adults got coverage under the Obamacare, also known as the Affordable Care Act. Obamacare is, I believe, a very misunderstood bill. Obamacare facts is actually the number one Google search when you type in Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. Since it's such a highly contested bill, I think it's ever more important to know exactly what it covers. According to the White House's official site, the goal of the bill is to protect the rights of the insured, control insurance costs, increase eligibility, and increase tax credits for employers. So they go on to state that the rights of the uninsured include continued coverage even after the diagnosis of a serious injury or illness, reduced premiums, and in lifelong insurance plans. In the United States, healthcare is extremely expensive and ever increasingly so. It is going up at 6.3% over the last year, and that rate of inflation seems to be on a trend to continue to rise. And it consistently increases about 4 times the rate of salary increases. So every year you're paying 4 times as much as health insurance, then you are getting an increase. So that's much more money out of your pocket than for inflation represented through your salary. It also brings up issues about whether people can access healthcare, who can access healthcare, who healthcare is really for, the wealthy or every person, and what is the government's responsibility in healthcare, if any, depending on who you ask. It brings up ethical issues for doctors as well, who are under pressure to prescribe both from large pharmaceutical companies and also from their patients not to prescribe them the medicine they might need because it is too expensive, or testing which might benefit them because also it is too expensive. Hospitals, however, under some insurance plans, look to do as much testing that is covered and nothing more. So sometimes tests are ordered not on a basis of need, but rather due to financial concerns. In other news, Saudi women have gotten the right to vote, though they still do not have the right to drive their car. So they're either busing it or walking or getting a ride with a man to the polls. The Eurozone is continuing work on a new economic plan to try to avoid serious downturn in the economy and a default of Greece and other large nations, though, according to recent reports, they have kind of resigned themselves to the default of Greece and have begun almost preparing for collision. All of this in an attempt to try to save the European Union's shared currency, the euro. A drug submarine was seized in Colombia, which exports cocaine mostly to the US, Canada, and Europe. Whether the drugs are still should be considered illicit substances and whether making them so and keeping them so improves the quality of life for Americans as well as our foreign policy is up for debate. It's hard to say, especially with the increasing abuse of prescription drugs and the increasing strength of prescription drugs with new research and new formulations, that cocaine and heroin and other such drugs, which are currently targets in the war on drugs, are worse and should warrant a huge investment of time, resources, and taxpayer dollars to maintain their illegal status, as well as increasing our prison populations. By the way, prisoners get a relatively high level of health care in prison. Also, an ethical issue brought up many times. First of all, whether it is fair that non-criminals do not have that same level of healthcare, and further, whether it would be ethical to lock someone up and then deny them important medical care. In other news, the World Bank has increased drought aid to the Horn of Africa, including the affected countries of Kenya, Ethiopia, and Somalia. An estimated 10,000 individuals have died so far from malnutrition in the region. It has been estimated that as the effects of global warming are felt across the world, the third world will suffer especially in their food productions over the coming years, as they do not have the resources or technology to adapt farming techniques to an ever-changing climate. In science news, it has been recently determined to a better extent that humans reached Asia in two waves. This was found out by mitochondrial DNA testing. For those of you who aren't familiar with mitochondrial DNA, these are the DNA in a small organelle, which is kind of like the cell's version of an organ. And these organelles are the powerhouses of the cell. So all the energy that your cell is using, all the energy the cell in my mouth is using, and hopefully the energy my brain is using to fire neurons so I can form these thoughts to share with you, of quality or not, is from the mitochondria, which has its own DNA. And this DNA is inherited maternally only, so from your mother. It's uniquely female, kind of like the Y chromosome is uniquely male, except the Y chromosome is in the nucleus, not in the DNA. Is in the nucleus, while the mitochondrial DNA is in the mitochondria. So these scientists look at mitochondrial DNA in fossils, and they found that two populations arrived early and bred the Denisovans, which are kind of analogous to a Asian Neanderthal, and early arrivers of modern humans, and they were believed to interbreed. However, the early arrivers seem to have overtaken these Denisovians or Asian Neanderthals. And then a second wave came and bred with the earlier arrivers to create the indigenous Asian people that we currently have based off of their mitochondrial DNA. So their mothers passed down to their children. In news, we look the understanding of the negative effects on asbestos has been flushed out a little more. And oddly enough, it seems as though cells too can choke. And they can choke on nanotubes and things that mirror nanotubes like asbestos. So cells have this process of engulfing particles to bring into the cell to later digest. And by bringing, in general, they expect these particles that they bring in to be spherical. However, things like nanotubes are not spherical. They are tube-like. They stick out in a projection. So as the cell tries to engulf this tube, they appear to almost choke on it since they can't digest it and the tube gets stuck, which may mean that the cell morphs and eventually causes death. Knowing this, it can lead to safer modifications of asbestos and other synthetic materials. So if they do enter our body, they do not cause massive apoptosis and or mutation. Further, microRNAs can affect your body. They are called mRNAs. They are actually the nucleic acids, which are translated into your proteins. They are taken from DNA mostly. However, a recent study shows they can also be taken from plants. It has been studied in blood samples from a large Chinese population that they had a significant number of rice mRNAs. A recent study also used these plant MRAs to control cholesterol in mice. This means that eventually you could be eating food that contains special microRNAs, which tells your body to make certain proteins and then changes your metabolism or works as a genetic therapy. So plants working for medicine. I think eating a very delicious mango with a cholesterol mRNA in it might be better than swallowing a huge horse pill, personally. Finally, some last science news. Hearts beat in response to light. A recent study of cardiomyocyte stem cells, which are stem cells which have been made into cardiac muscles, were shown to mirror the light flashes of a scientist. So the cells were beating at their own pace, and then the scientists flashed a certain pattern of light at them, and these heart cells actually mimicked it. This could eventually lead to light-based pacemakers. So you'd have a little light in your chest that would flash on and off to make sure your heart stays regular. Neutrinos, recently, in a study at CERN, were shown to fly faster than the speed of light. While not confirmed yet, there are multiple tests that seem to support this hypothesis. And if confirmed, this would violate Einstein's theory of relativity and pretty much turn the physics world on its head. So keep your ears tuned for that. In healthcare, there have been two major breakthroughs. One, a recent procedure has been developed to create glowing cancers. Some cancers have specific expression of surface proteins. These are proteins on the outside of the cell. And these surface proteins actually have special sites where fluorescent molecules can bond. So about 2 hours before treatment, a doctor would ingest these fluorescent tags into your body. These tags would then attach at a much higher rate to cancer cells than normal cells. And when the doctor comes in to operate, he could find those fluorescent tags and know exactly what and how much to cut out of, which is much better than a lot of current techniques, which involve pathologists and making slides and cutting and then cutting more and then cutting around to be safe, though sometimes missing things. This way you can know exactly where the cancer is, which greatly increases the odds of survival for cancer patients. Further in science news, there is a increasing interest in mammoth hemoglobin. These hemoglobin are actually the red blood cells you're familiar with in your body. Why would we be interested in mammoth hemoglobin, you might ask? Well, it's believed that these proteins are especially adapted to function well in cold temperatures, as they would in the ice age, theoretically. Also, these proteins could be easily modified from both African elephants and humans into some sort of synthetic, but structurally similar to mammoth blood, but usable in humans, blood cells that could be used during hypothermic procedures. Now, some very specialized procedures involve cooling the body down to extremely low temperatures, and these include heart and neuro procedures. It's a fairly dangerous process, and so this way is a way to make sure that a higher percentage of oxygen is still getting to all your organs, though your body temperature has dropped. Now, for our last thing, we're going to hold our very first Journal Club Junior. So hear ye, hear ye. This is the first meeting of the Splice Journal Club. Today, we are covering a paper from Nature Genetics called Increased Exonic De Novo Mutation Rate in Individuals with Schizophrenia. While that sounds very intimidating, it really means that the rate of genetic errors or genetic mutations in patients with schizophrenia is higher than the average population. That means when they compare the genome of patients with schizophrenia compared to the genome of their parents, they have more differences than a normal person. This could be due to a mutation in DNA replication proteins or DNA repair proteins, and could explain why it's been so difficult to isolate the specific gene which affects schizophrenics, but no one else. The author of the paper also previously proposed this type of mutation as a major player in autism, and will continue to follow up that lead in the future, as well as studying schizophrenia further. See? There you go. The end of the first junior journal club of Splice. Now, time to wrap up the show with my top 5 genetic disorders in order of increasing interest to me. Number 1, colorblindness. Colorblindness actually affects my grandfather, which means I'm likely to be a carrier, so maybe I should not have any male children. Colorblindness is the poor functioning or non-development of retinal cones which perceive light. So these are the cones in the back of your eye that That light hits them and they send signals to your brain about what color it is. It is a X-linked, X being a sex chromosome you inherit, trait. So males are more likely to get it since they only have one copy of the X chromosome. They have XY, making the male, compared to females who have XX, two chromosomes. So it's a recessive. So one dominant non-colorblind gene can cover up one colorblind X chromosome. There are a lot of philosophical arguments that have actually stemmed almost based off of colorblindness around how we perceive the world and if we can perceive the world in the same way. And thus, is there any actual truth that we have since our inputs might vary between person and person? There is also some evidence that colorblindness helps individuals see through particular camouflage, perhaps providing an evolutionary advantage, which might be the reason it represents such a large portion of our population, between 7 and 10% of males and only around 0.8% of females. Because, as we mentioned, it is a X-linked trait, which means females have a more chance of having two X chromosomes, one of which could cover up the trait. Number four, Down syndrome. Now, there have been many people famous with Down syndrome, including some lauded and awarded actors, as well as Sarah Palin's youngest child. Down syndrome is a chromosomal condition which results from the presence of an entire or partial third copy of the 21st chromosome. This means that something went wrong in making the reproductive cells and there was an extra chromosome, the extra 21st chromosome, hanging around somewhere. Down syndrome can be diagnosed in utero, which means they have special techniques to take a sample from the fetus or the fluid around the fetus and analyze it to see if there is a 21st chromosome using a method called karyotyping. Down syndrome has variable symptoms and can range from severe to moderate. It almost always presents with neurological issues, including retardation. The chance of having a child with Down syndrome increases drastically with maternal age. Studies are currently being conducted if paternal age might also be involved. The rate of Down syndrome is approximately 1 per 900 children, though this is only an estimate. The next, number three in my list of favorite genetic disorders, is the recessive metabolic disorder phenylketonuria. Yes, I know it's hard to say. It's most often called the much easier to pronounce PKU. PKU is a disorder in which the enzyme to metabolize the amino acid phenylalanine to tyrosine is reduced. This causes problems if not treated with a special diet, with brain development and function leading to mental retardation, brain damage, and seizures. Because this amino acid cannot be broken down, it actually accumulates and causes problems within the neurocells. This requires patients with PKU to eat a low phenylalanine diet. It includes eliminating a huge variety of foods since this is a major amino acid. These foods include meat, chicken, fish, eggs, nuts, cheese, beans, milk, potatoes, bread, pasta, and corn. Also, they can have only a very limited number of artificial sweeteners, since most artificial sweeteners also include this amino acid. The presence of this gene varies across populations greatly. In Turkey, the rate of occurrence is 1 in 2006. However, this is on the high end, and in Finland, it's fewer than 1 in 100,000. In the US, if you're curious, it's 1 in 15,000. Also, our local pharmaceutical company, BioMarin Pharmaceuticals, has a drug which actually replaces, to some extent, this enzyme, allowing a much larger diet for these children. All right, we're getting near the end. Here's the good ones. Number 2, sickle cell anemia. This is a blood disorder in which red blood cells assume a sickle cell shape. It is caused by an incomplete dominant trait on chromosome 11. Some of the bad things about sickle cell anemia is it does affect your ability to carry oxygen. It also shortens life expectancy and can increase the chances of severe blood clots and stroke. It is most common in tropical and subtropical regions because it serves as a defense against malaria. Malaria is a disease virus that spreads from mosquitoes, and its cycle includes infecting a red blood cell. This red blood cell then bursts and releases more of malaria. However, these sickle cell anemics, as well as people who have one copy of this trait, so do not have the disease, but have a copy, have altered red blood cells, which interrupt this cycle and helps protect them against malaria, providing them with a strong genetic advantage, which is why sickle cell anemia is so common in these populations. It occurs in 1 in 5,000 individuals, and it is actually believed to have evolved 3 separate times within the population. All right, my number 1 genetic disease, neurodegenerative genetic disorder, Huntington's disease, which leads to muscle coordination and cognitive decline. It's actually a really tragic disease for the individuals who have it. It usually only begins to present symptoms in individuals when they are between 35 and 44. There's a huge ethical debate within the Huntington community about when a person is mature enough to be tested for this disease and be able to emotionally handle all the implications of having a positive result. Huntington's disease is a result of the mutation in the HTT protein, which has multiple roles in the cell, though these roles are not fully understood. However, HTT protein does act as an anti-apoptotic agent. This means that it acts as a mechanism to prevent cell death. If you're more interested in what you can do to help those with genetic diseases, check out the Hereditary Disease Foundation, which provides grants for research labs looking at hereditary diseases. You might also want to look at the FDA's information about special legislation for orphan diseases. These special legislations try to encourage commercial pharmaceutical companies to invest in the expensive and lengthy research needed to provide drugs for a very limited population represented by these genetic diseases. There are also multiple charities that work by sharing the genetic information from genome screens of individuals with genetic diseases to scientists. However, there are multiple ethical issues about sharing the entire genome of someone with this disease. So, this is the end of Splice. I hope you join us next week, same time, same place, from 6 to 7 here on radio.dominican.edu. This was the first part of what is quickly expanding to be a 3, perhaps 4-part series on genetics, and eventually I will get around to stem cell genetics. Be sure to stay tuned for the Hot Spot with DJ Juice, the Power Hour with Sam I.M., and then the 9 o'clock hour with 2 Mellow, all coming up here on radio.dominican.edu. Now, in what is quickly becoming a Splice tradition, we're going to end our song with Science is Real by They Might Be Giants as a friendly reminder that science is real. After that, we'll have the DNA song, which I really like, and I hope you enjoy as well. So thank you for listening, and remember, science is real, and Splice is on from 6 to 7. From the Big Bang.